You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivasa Prakash.
This episode of Market Champions is brought to you by Simplify ETFs. For more information, visit simplify.us. No Simplify funds will be discussed during this podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today we've got Kyle Scanlon, a partner at OnDeck and a financial content creator. So thank you so much for being on the podcast, Kyle. It's great to have you.
Yeah, super happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how exactly did you actually get into finance? You know, what got you interested and, you know, how do you begin your journey into finance?
I started trading options when I was in high school. So around the same age that you are, right? I was into it then. And for me, it was like always about like the structure of money. I wasn't super interested in making money, which is detrimental sometimes. So I got into it. I majored in finance in school and econ. I then graduated and went to go work in asset management at Capital Group and have always just been like super fascinated by like this living being structure that is like the market, right? And have tried to study it because it's so interesting.
So, you know, have you dedicated most of sort of your trading efforts to, you know, via, you know, options, or have you sort of diversified away?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the option space and like learning about them and studying them. Right now, I'm more so like a long portfolio. I trade covered calls mostly. I don't really do as much trading as I used to. I'm really trying to learn a lot more about crypto. So I've been focusing a lot of my energy on that space versus options trading. But there's room for both. I just have to, you know, time is a scarce resource. So.
Got it. And, you know, since you brought up crypto, you know, we should probably start off with crypto. So, sure. So overall, what are your thoughts on crypto? So do you think, you know, do you think Bitcoin or Ethereum or one of the cryptocurrencies, do you think that, you know, that is sort of a sustainable monetary standard to base our, you know, money system upon?
Yeah, I mean, I think that everything has merit, right? With regards to Ethereum, like I don't think of Ethereum like money. I think of Ethereum like a platform. Obviously, like Ether is a form of currency. But I think that, you know, what Bitcoin is trying to accomplish is a little bit hard because right now a lot of people are using it as a store of value, as an asset versus a currency, because you can't really, you know, buy something with something that fluctuates so rapidly. It just wouldn't be sustainable as a currency model. So I think like that's the big thing that's, you know, tough with crypto is like, is it a currency? Is it an asset? Is it a platform? And I think there's room for it to be all three. It's just going to have to be different iterations. And I don't think, personally, I'm not sure if Bitcoin's answering that question right now. I'm sure in the future, like there's plans for it to do so, but in regards to your exact question about it being a currency, like I don't see that manifesting at the moment. Yeah.
Got it. One other thing is, when it comes to the monetary system, what are your thoughts on sort of, you know, gold standard or fixed currencies versus fiat, or in a way unfixed or unlimited currencies? So, you know, so what is your personal view and, you know, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, so like right now, the US is in such a tough situation because if we were tied to the gold standard, like there's no way that we would be able to print like we did during the pandemic. So I think like that's sort of the thing that, you know, not being tied to a certain standard allows us to do is like when there's a crisis, like you're able to, like what, you know, why the whole reason we got off the gold standard is because you're able to, you know, do this sort of thing and to print money and to, you know, provide both fiscal and monetary support. But I think, yeah, I think it's important to like have some sort of like guidelines or barriers around the way that we think about currency. Like right now, I do think that it is a little bit concerning with regards to some of the numbers that we're seeing, just some of the easing that we're seeing and how it keeps on going on. Like there doesn't seem to be much of a sign of tapering. So mm-hmm. I think that's like the biggest thing. And that's not really with regards to like currency and being tied to something. I just think it's more so around, you know, being good custodians of the money.
Got it. And you know, when you think about the digital asset space as a whole, so you know, could you explain, number one, what is a DAO, and you know, what is your opinion, or a DAO, and what is your so can you break it down? And
oh man, yeah, I was so proud of that title. So like DAOs are really interesting, and they were one of my first like deep dives into crypto. And everybody, like Linda, who wrote a piece on Mirror, did like a really great breakdown, and my piece was like just sort of breaking down her piece. But yeah, I mean, I think they're super interesting. The reason I got into them is because I'm a creator, and I was like, okay, it's, you know, hard to monetize as a creator. Like you don't see some of the upside of your pieces doing well, or you just, it feels very like extractive sometimes. So like maybe DAOs are the answer to that. So I did some research, and basically what they are is a way to automate an organization. So instead of having, you know, an HR department or a payroll processing department, all of that's going to be automated away through smart contracts. So you have that aspect of it automated away. So it's more efficient, it's more effective, et cetera. And instead of having like five suits in a boardroom making all the decisions, you're going to have the broader group making the decision. So it's a lot more decentralized, as the name would suggest. And that way, you know, it's a little bit more transparent. It's a little bit more accessible to people. And it doesn't feel like it's that, you know, hierarchy that we normally have at the corporate level. It's much more flat. So I think like from that perspective, if you're like looking for a flat organization that you can really like participate in the upside on, because you have these tokens which you're able to use to vote on protocols that pass through, like that's going to be a pretty cool in terms of how we think about organizations. I think getting like human resources, some aspects of that, and payroll like automated away is going to be really valuable for corporations because they don't have to spend all that money on overhead. But I do think that there's still like a human aspect that DAOs haven't quite solved for. It's hard to, right? Like it's just hard to automate everything that we are. So yeah, I mean, I think they're very interesting. I think it's the early stages for sure. But yeah, that's kind of the breakdown.
Got it. And you know, one aspect of DAOs is, you know, the concept of a smart contract, which sort of automates stuff, you know, when you know, when certain criteria is met, or you know, when certain criteria is met. And so do you personally think, you know, smart contracts as a whole, you know, are better than humans at making decisions? Then do you think that DAOs are better than, you know, suits in a boardroom, as you described it? Because some people would describe, you know, some people would point to, you know, companies say Google or Microsoft or something, and they would proceed to argue that, you know, if it wasn't for the suits in the boardroom, you know, it would not have been possible. So so number one, do you think DAOs as a whole are, you know, superior to the current way or the traditional way of decision making? And what in your opinion is the future of DAOs?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're superior. I just think they're different. Like, I think that there's room in organizations to bring employees in a little bit more. I think that that should be something that's done a little bit more in terms of like, even just like, you know, how you think about like vacation, how you think about like organizations operating as a whole. Like it'd just be interesting to gather that data on how employees are feeling, actually gather that data in terms of like voting, like how invested are they? And I think, you know, a lot of people, and this is something that's always like boggled me, but it makes sense. Like, you know, a lot of people don't have equity in the corporations that they work for. And so if you're in a DAO, you're able to participate in the upside of this organization doing well, which is going to incentivize you hypothetically, right? To, you know, be a little bit more involved, to vote a little bit more on the protocols, to pass views through some of your own ideas. And I think that is the sign of an effective organization. I think right now, the problem with corporate America is they're monotonous, right? Like it's just the same thing over and over again. And it's always been done this way. I think DAOs are a little bit different just because they're like iterating on that idea. Like, yes, you do need to have a corporate structure, but here's how it can be a little bit different. So I don't know if one is like, I mean, the way that I'm describing it sounds like I like DAOs. I don't know if like one's better or worse. I just think that DAOs, you know, kind of rethink, there's a lot of issues with them, but they rethink how we have corporations, which I think is really important, because we do have like, you know, the BlackRock, Larry Fink came out the other day and was like, Americans are going to have to invest a little bit riskier in order to like save for retirement. And it's like, dude, well, you have so much of their money. Like, what are you doing? Like, why wouldn't you create better products? And all that being said, like, I think DAOs you know, would sort of not necessarily dismantle BlackRock as a whole, but would allow people to participate more in that upside. They don't have to take as much investment risk because they're playing the game along the way. Like Larry Fink has been playing the game the whole time. But if you allow people to actually participate in the upside of their corporation, like Larry Fink has done with BlackRock, that's going to, you know, leave them better off down the road, assuming the corporation does well, right?
Yep. And, you know, well, and, you know, in your article, you sort of share examples, especially, you know, by connecting it to finance. So could you sort of share some examples? So, for example, you talked about automated market makers and so on and so forth. And could you talk about, you know, how DAOs help, you know, make this a little different?
Yeah, so this is where my knowledge ends. I'm still wrapping my head around all that stuff. And the reason I left that part short is because I still need to do a little bit of research. I think, like, you know, there's exchanges, right? So it's going to be peer-to-peer versus how you have middlemen in current financial markets. So I think that's really interesting, you know, removing that. Like, that's what the whole, you know, GameStop debacle is kind of all about. It's like, okay, you know, Citadel, whatever. So I think that's pretty valuable in terms of how you think about, you know, financial exchanges and financial organizations getting rid of that middleman. And I think that's like an interesting aspect about DAOs in general, is like basically all of middle management, which is, you know, a large portion of society probably, and it would be removed. Yeah.
Got it. And, you know, so far we've sort of, at least in your own words, you've sort of sounded extremely bullish on DAOs, you know, employees making decisions and, you know, PIBA and organizations and companies overall being better off. So what is sort of the bear case? What is sort of the case against DAOs, and, you know, what could actually cause it to, you know, in a way fail?
Well, this is just like a problem with my, I think, ethos. Like, I'm very bullish on the idea of things. Like, I do know that there's like technical complexities, but I think the idea of DAOs are just super interesting. I don't know if I'm like super, super bullish on them, but I think, like, at the end of the day, you have issues with like human nature. Like, the idea that you can have a flat hierarchy, I think, is interesting, but will that work? I'm not sure. It seems like everybody always wants to rise to power eventually. So I wonder, and I know that there's like protocols in place for the DAOs to like not have that happen. And obviously, like, several have been successful without that. But then you have like the DAO back in 2016 that got hacked. And so you have Ethereum Classic and Ethereum now. So I think that, like, humans are cool, but they're also like uncool sometimes. And I think that's like the bear case with everything, right? And legality is an issue. So it's not legal in some places. And then, like, in crypto in general, there's the big problem of like rug pulls. And so there's always something that could go wrong. And I think in DAOs, because they're a little bit new, they're a little bit more vulnerable to that.
Got it. And then moving on to, you know, other aspects of digital assets. So far we've sort of covered DAOs, and we've covered, I guess, crypto as well. So do you have any thoughts on, say, for example, NFTs, and do you think sort of the use of NFTs is going to expand over time? And, you know, and you know, the last part is, we'll actually answer those first. I'll get to the last one.
Yeah, I mean, so I wrote a piece about, or mentioned in a piece about NFTs when I did a piece on like Elon, and sort of just like how weird the market was at the beginning of the year. And I was like, oh, NFTs don't make a whole lot of sense. Like, I was the digital JPEG, like, how can you do that? But I think that, you know, a lot of the way that we invest is just collective belief behind the value of an asset. So I think that if people drive value to NFTs, they're valuable, right? End of the day, full stop, it doesn't matter. So I think like that's really interesting. And I think that there's a lot of really cool ways that artists can monetize, creators can monetize. Like, I could theoretically NFT my TikToks and sell them. And that could be really cool because that's like, you know, you're an artist, right? And why wouldn't you want to, you know, execute on your art? So I think that's like a really cool idea. So I like them. I think that there's a lot of, like, because they have that big bubble, it was a bubble. It's just going to have to like find its path, but now it's not so bubbly. And I think that there's going to be a lot of kinks that are worked out in the system.
All right, and what do you think of, you know, the argument that, you know, let's say, you know, there's an NFT that's a picture, you know, people could just go on Google, search up the same picture and save it to their computer. So, what do you think of sort of that being the bear case against NFTs? It's not real. It's in a way, even its name, you know, it's non-fungible. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, so like NFTs are not like really the picture themselves, right? Like they're the pointer to the asset. And so, yeah, you could have the JPEG, whatever. Like I could have a copy of Picasso and say it's Picasso. But at the end of the day, like, you know, the pointer to the asset is going to be what drives the ultimate value. And that's going to be that validation, that, yeah, that key, that string of text. So I think that's, you know, that's what it is. Like, yeah. I mean, I think that there are a lot of problems in terms of like counterfeit, I think, maybe. But the system will have to work it all out, and I hope it does. But I think they're interesting, and I think that it will be worked out. And just we're moving so quickly in terms of validation and execution online that I can't imagine that it would be super bad forever, if that makes sense.
Got it. So another thing that, you know, I wanted to shift and talk about, you know, shifting away from the digital asset space. One thing that you've written about on your Substack is this concept of the dollarization of America. And it's not, you know, it's not exactly that everyone uses dollars. It's more of, you know, stuff like Dollar General and the dollar store and, you know, I guess budget stores, you know, becoming extremely common. So could you talk a little bit about that and what makes that significant?
Do you have dollar stores in Canada?
So we've got our version of dollar stores. So
okay, so you do. Yeah,
yep.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so like I'm from Kentucky, and like it was very normal to like always see a dollar store like at almost every corner, and they target rural towns, and they just really find almost like big fuels, and they just plop themselves down in them. And like what they do really well is they find these food deserts, and usually it's you know, a population that has a lower income. They're able to like find those people, plop down, and serve food. More or less, they're not necessarily quote unquote a grocery store, or that wasn't their original design. Now they're sort of shifting towards that, like offering fresh produce, especially Dollar General. But yeah, I mean, the main thing is like they're one in every three new stores being built is a dollar store. Wow. Which is crazy. Yeah, it's absolutely insane. Like, and the idea that that's going to keep on happening, and they already have a lot of stores, is pretty wild. So like, and what happens, I think it's every time that they go to a new area, I think sales and around like in the surrounding grocery area declined by about 30%. So they're going there. Yeah. And they're extracting value from the other stores, and they're taking customers. And the huge issue with them is like, and I did a Twitter thread about it, this, and there was like a lot of comments like, oh, but it's, you know, cheap and people should be able to have access to cheap goods. And it's like, sure, it's cheap, but it's actually more expensive because you're getting smaller products for like less prices, but it's still more expensive. And the issue with that is like, okay, so, you know, it is, lots of people know that it's sort of that shrinkflation sort of thing where it's more expensive, but it's smaller. It's more cost per unit. And, but the issue is like, you only have a certain amount of money to spend on your groceries that week. So that's all you can do. Even if it is smaller, you still can't go potentially to Costco and spend $28 on toilet paper. You just don't have that, that freedom. And so I think that's where dollar stores really get a lot of value, is they're the cheaper sticker price. And sometimes that's like what you have to do, right? Sticky customer base, which is super sad.
Yeah. You know, so one of the things about, you know, dollar stores is that I'm guessing their margins are probably smaller because, you know, they charge lower prices. So do you think that overall, you know, this dollar business is, I guess, in a way sustainable? Or do you think that, you know, especially because, you know, the margins are so thin, you know, a small hit to the business could actually make it go under. So so what are your thoughts on, you know, sort of the sustainability of dollar stores?
They have decent margins. Yeah, they have better margins than Walmart, Target. So I think like the big thing with them, and like the bear case that, and I'm sure other people would maybe disagree, but the bear case that I came up with them is if Amazon decides that Amazon wants to be a dollar store and to have like little dollar store outlets everywhere, you know, the same way that they have their warehouses, they could easily do that. And I could see them easily disrupting, you know, the dollar store model. Amazon didn't choose to do that, and they chose to go like for these wealthy nodes called Whole Foods. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that would be like my bear case in terms of dollar stores is if Amazon steps in.
Amazon ruins everything. I'm kidding. so one thing that you also included in your article is George Washington. And I guess the psychology, psychology of George Washington. So could you talk a little bit about how that, you know, connects with, you know, your dollarization thesis?
Oh yeah, that was just a reference to like the $1 bill. Yeah. I mean, there it's just like it's sort of like that because it's a consumer psychology mindset where people are like, oh, this is cheaper. Like it's only one George Washington. Fun joke. Yep. Terrible joke. And I think that was like the main thing is people are basically more or less tricked into paying less, but it's actually more expensive. Just because it's cheaper doesn't mean it's cheaper, right? And you like people, there's a lot of stuff on Twitter where people post like, you know, toilet paper for $28 at Costco, like $30 rolls for $28, so like $1.07 a roll, and then at Dollar General, 6 rolls, $9, $1.50 a roll. So it is more expensive, but people get sucked into that lower sticker price.
Got it. So now I wanted to move on and talk a little bit about, you know, QE and inflation. So, you know, a lot of people try and argue. So what is your view on inflation and QE? Let's start with that.
So I do a lot of I did a lot of TikToks on inflation. Like, yes, I felt like I was, yeah, I felt like I was always like inflation, inflation expectations. Yep. So, I mean, I was very worried, and then I was like, okay, maybe it's transitory. And then I saw rent prices start to go up and I was like, that's not good. Because if rent prices are starting to go up, that means that people are being priced out of homes. And that means that there are not enough homes. And like that sort of like rent cycle, I think it's pretty inflammatory, inflationary. So I'm a little bit worried about that. And like a big thing with me and like why I was so worried about inflation was sort of the supply chain crisis that we were seeing. Like lumber was through the roof, yep. Copper was through the roof, but all the commodities have basically recovered. More or less. And so I think that was like really worrying, but now you're seeing it in food prices. Like, I can't remember who it was, but maybe it was Dole, because Dole's going public and they were like, we're going to have to pass off these higher costs to our consumers. But you're starting to see a lot more of that where people are like, oh, we're going to have to pass off these costs to consumers. And I think it was Olive Garden. Olive Garden like had killer margins and like there was no reason that they should have, or it was killer profit for the year. And basically they passed all of the inflationary costs of food, labor, et cetera, off to the consumers. So I think we're going to see, and if that starts to happen, if companies like start to pass off costs to consumers, that's where we're really going to see inflation and things are really going to be worrisome. And I think like inflation and things that we need, so like food, et cetera, rent, is really bad. The inflation in like higher end products, I think is okay because most of the time, says people are choosing to consume those products. But yeah, I think that's like the big worry is that we have inflation in things that we need, deflation in things that we want. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, what in your view sort of
moving on from that rant. You said anyway, and I thought it was funny. Sorry.
I wanted to pick your brains on what do you think? So you mentioned, you know, supply chains as sort of the cause of inflation. You mentioned that with commodities like copper and lumber. So number one, do you think these supply shortages are temporary? And number two, what role do you think QE plays in causing inflation?
Yeah. So with regards to supply chains, like I think some of it is temporary. Like I think companies can build and, you know, execute on supply chains pretty quickly. And it's not that big of a worry. I think like with regards to like raw materials, like copper, et cetera, like I think that's worrying, especially if there's like overseas tension, which there is with the semiconductors. I think that sort of stuff is worrying. And that's where I can see inflation being more than transitory. And I think also like there's, you know, labor issues, right? Like companies are probably not paying people enough. People don't really want to go back to work. And yep. I think that sort of thing, that human capital supply chain, it could be, you know, inflationary as well. Mm-hmm. With regards to QE, you said, do I think it's worrisome?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, why? Why are you get it? Because like now we have the Delta variant. I think it's like a little bit worrisome. And I talk about this a lot on TikTok too. It's like, okay, so they say it's, you know, they're gonna start talking about tapering, and now they're talking about tapering. But the Fed, what they're looking for is full employment. And if we have a labor market like we have now, like that's just not going to happen for a while. So I think like the worries of inflation are going to have to outweigh the worries of or the goal of full employment. I don't know like what Jerome's MO with that is, like how worried is he about inflation? I'm not sure. But I think that's like the big thing is like this weird dual mandate that they have, having to like balance those two variables. Yep. That almost like they are related, but they're also not. Like that's so hard. It is such a hard job and I get it. Like it's almost easier to be like, oh, the stock market loves it, right? It's almost easier to just be like, okay, QE forever. Hands off. Like we'll roll out a bond ETFs, but that's about it. We'll support the treasury market as well. We'll have RRP for you. Don't worry. No worries, everybody. I think that's the thing is we're addicted to QE.
So so would you argue or would you also sort of put for the point that fiscal policy and the stimulus checks that have been given out to a lot of these people. Do you think that all that plays a major role in causing the labor shortage that the Fed is worrying about right now?
I don't know. I mean, potentially, like I read a research paper that said a lot of the labor shortage wasn't caused by people who got stimulus checks or whatever. It's more so caused by like people just not wanting to go back to work. I think the main group was like middle-aged moms, maybe. I don't quote me on that, but I think that there's this wage problem. Like people feel like they're not being paid enough. Perhaps they're not being paid enough to sort of do the work. So I think that's the main thing that companies are going to have to grapple with is like how much do we pay? But and the weird thing is, and this is why I don't want to say yes or no to your question because I truly don't know the answer. Is like some of these companies will be like, and it's like just. As an example, like McDonald's, like it'd be a company like McDonald's for like a cashier position being like $2,000 signing bonus and people still aren't choosing that. So I don't know what the gap is. Yeah.
Got it. And one other accusation that's placed on QE by a lot of people, especially on, FinTwit is that, QE is leading to a rise in asset prices and it's causing a bubble in markets, especially both the bond market and the stock market. So to what extent do you agree with that? And do you think that QE actually plays a role in, boosting asset prices?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, I would say so, like, because it's liquidity creates money, well, more or less, it creates easing conditions, which helps people to spend more money. And ultimately, some of that money is going to end up in the stock market. So I do think that in the Fed, it was like in directly supporting the stock market this time around and the bond market, like they swooped in for high yield bonds, like in a way that I've never seen. I haven't seen a lot of stuff, but yeah, that was a gross laugh. But yeah, I think the Fed has definitely done a lot of supporting of the market with QE.
Got it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to move on from sort of markets and talk about, content creation. And sure. So do you have sort of a long-term goal or are you just at the moment sort of riding the wave and, especially because number one, TikTok has sort of a pretty high reach compared to other platforms. So what is sort of your long-term goal with, the content that you create right now?
Yeah, I mean, my long-term goal is financial education. So right now I'm A/B testing a lot of different things and trying to figure that out and trying to figure it, make it work somehow. So yeah, financial education, a financial education platform, this is like big brain stuff, but like reinventing the way that we think about financial education. Like it doesn't have to be something that's dry. It doesn't have to be something that's inaccessible. And I think also tying into that, like financial media, like how do you sort of create content that doesn't gatekeep, that isn't super confusing, that isn't like, oh, today the 10-year rose, like why did the 10-year rise? Like how do you create paths for people to understand this stuff? Like that's my long-term goal with this and what I'm trying to do is working towards like rediscovering how we think about financial education and as well as like how we consume financial news.
Got it. And what in your opinion sort of makes a good piece of content?
I mean, beyond like the retweets and stuff. I mean, so like there have been I have several different, I'm on a lot of platforms. So I have like a YouTube channel, I have a Substack, I have a TikTok, and then I have my Twitter, and then I have an Instagram where I like cross post. But I think for me, like a good piece of content is one where people like walk away and they like learn something. And so a lot of times that learning can be unassuming learning. Like they could have laughed at something, but been like, oh my God, that just connected the dot. Like for my mixed supply chain video, I tied together like all these different concepts into this like one video. And that's like the whole goal, right? Like how do you tie together all these different ideas? And so I think if people can understand like the way that the thread moves through markets, like potentially through the videos, that's like good content, right? Like if you're able to connect these ideas, do it in 60 seconds, right? Do it short form so they can just consume it, then move on. That's really powerful. And I hope that's like what happens. I know sometimes they probably come across as memes, but yeah, that's what I hope.
And, you know, how hard is it to actually, you know, distill down, you know, I guess, say, for example, how hard is it to simplify reverse repo markets and, you know, make a TikTok about it? So, and sort of, what are the challenges that you face, you know, being a content creator?
What are the challenges I face?
Yep.
Just in general?
Yep.
Or,
yeah.
As a content creator? I mean, I think sometimes, like, it's a super weird dynamic, right? Because you're producing free content, and people come to expect a certain type of content out of you because that's like what you produce. And so if you like shift lanes a little bit, there's some people who love the new stuff, but then there's some people that hate the new stuff and they're like, just go back to who you were. And I haven't been doing it that long, but I've tried a couple of different types of content with my audience. And there's some that hate the skits, which I like the mixed supply chain one. They're like, this is terrible, go back. And then there's also like the daily market updates. Some people love that. Some people are like, go back to being funny. so yeah, I mean, I think like the always being very online and also like for TikTok, having your full face out there, having your full voice, people just choose to like criticize you or say like weird stuff. So I think that's the main thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, how much time does it take just per day to actually, you know, sit down, make content?
So I make content for myself and then I make content for a few brands too. I right now, so I have a full-time job. So I would say that I wake up pretty early. I would say that I would spend like maybe 5 hours a day on content. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
It's fun. Yeah, it's fun. I enjoy it.
And, you know, especially when it comes to TikToks, do you make them sort of extempore or do you sort of script them before you do them? How does that work?
Yeah. So for the daily market updates, I don't script them. I just sort of talk. And then the like skit ones, I script them out. But I do a little improv just to keep it fun, keep it lively. So.
Right. Got it. Well, Kyla, it's been awesome having you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so thank you so much for being on the podcast. You know, it was I had a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm super glad that you chose me to be a market champion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.